Thank you, Karina. I'm going to cover a couple of different topics that run from my personal interest in electrical stimulation and use of that to interact with brain, then to bridge directly into in part why I'm interested in the mechanics of tissue, and then some of the things sitting in front of the invasive stimulation community. But then more broadly, what kinds of effects that people observe in brain are coupled really into the mechanics. They all are part and of the same dynamics that you need to really understand the mechanics of brain tissue. Will also lead into the coupled physics of electromagnetics and of transport. So I'll get to just touch on a couple of those topics at the end of my talk. So I can't go through everybody who's contributed, but my longtime colleague Steve Schiff, Karina is somewhere in this picture. There she is, and the crew of people who do most of the work associated with this. So electrical stimulation has been thought of for treatment for various neurological effects for a very long time. This sketch is from the 1860s with some guy doing electrostatic discharges to treat malaise. Real electrical interaction with neural systems starts probably back with Galvani, who really ticked off Volta enough that Volta eventually developed the batteries so that he could show that Galvani was wrong. But then Galvani's nephew Aldini goes in and says, "Well, this is now I'm going to use Volta's cells, and I'm going to use that to interact with brain." And he had a plentiful supply of human brains to interact with from freshly decapitated people. And so he did a various set of experiments stimulating first individual people and then connecting them together. And then he moved on to try and say, well, let's do this in intact people. And the quote I have here is something like, having experimented on himself with electrodes in both ears or one ear in his mouth or on his forehead and nose, he experienced a strong reaction followed by prolonged insomnia lasting several days. He found the experience quite disagreeable, but thought the changes it brought might be salutary to the psychoses. This is a quote from one of Brazier's many histories of neurology. And that begins the therapy. So Aldini then goes on and uses this in his clinics to treat, to essentially do what we now call electroshock therapy. It fell it stopped being used for a while in the later 1800s. But then in the 1930s, another group of clinicians thought it was a good idea for more or less the same reasons, and with slightly better, more controlled hardware for generating now no longer DC stimuli but AC stimuli, got roughly the same kinds of results, inducing seizures and things that would then wipe out people's either memory, depression, or whatever was going on. Almost two decades later, we're still asking questions about where and how to better stimulate, and should we be doing invasive stimulation to cure things of whatever. And this is a slide I took from Tariq Haidar's group at Children's National Medical Center. And it just goes to show, in part, just how complicated neural systems are. What he's done is he's electroporated in the embryonic rat, actually this is mouse, the genetic code to express red fluorescent protein. And he's done this selectively in a way so that just the pyramidal neurons in, I think this is the right hippocampus, are gonna express this red fluorescent protein and do it selectively. And so then, I don't know, at 60 days after birth, the animals are sacrificed, sliced up, and this is the right hippocampus, this is the left hippocampus. You've got no cell bodies marked in the left hippocampus, but you still see quite a lot of red. And those of you who know enough about anatomy in rodents know that the hippocampi are fairly well connected. And all of this red is simply because these neurons, these pyramidal neurons, are projecting all the way into the contralateral hippocampus. So brain is, and I use this as a reminder, brain is a very, very connected system, distally connected as well as locally connected. And then if you're going to ask the question, how do you stimulate or where do you stimulate? If you're going to just stick an electrode in and you say, well, I'm going to put in a little shock of current, for example, you have to ask which part of these very long projections, you know, very long cells are you interacting with? And if you're going to be hitting fiber bundles, axon bundles, that are going from one place to another, what does it mean to be locally stimulating? Essentially, what you're doing is you're exciting output somewhere else, right? And that can be very broad. So for those people, my colleague Joe Francis, who spoke yesterday, is looking for ways to make sensory input. If he doesn't localize where he's stimulating, right, essentially he's stimulating whoever responds to his stimulus, right? Not the actual projections, but then the receivers of those neurons. And that's a kind of a common problem. Our group fell into or rediscovered about a decade and a half or so ago that if instead of using little pulses of stimuli, you use very low frequency electric fields, you can get a slightly different response from your neurons than you do if you put in very fast pulses of current. So instead of on axons pushing enough current to one spot to push it over threshold and activate an action potential, which then propagates out to the ends of the axons and produces output or synaptic input to the next layer, if you align an electric field, let me see if I have a picture. If you align the electric field along, now this is my physicist view of what a soma and dendrite look like. If you align the electric field along the pyramidal, the cell body to main trunk dendrite axis of a pyramidal neuron, you can push charge so that it accumulates at either end of this kind of long thing. This polarization takes a few tens of milliseconds, about maybe 20 milliseconds for a hippocampal pyramidal neuron, and then it saturates. So if you're talking about frequencies well below, say, 40 hertz, you get this kind of polarization effect. And this buildup at the soma then corresponds to a shift in the transmembrane potential. And that shift can be, well, if this axis is about 100 microns and the field is about 10 millivolts per millimeter, or then it this shift can be of order of millivolt. And a millivolt isn't enough to push you over threshold for action potential reliably, but it is enough to shift the neuron's position with respect to all of its input and make it fire off more readily or less readily, depending upon which the sign is. So all of a sudden, I have a flexible way to modulate the activity of this pyramidal neuron by polarizing it on fairly long timescales, long with respect to the timescale of a single action potential. then if you look at the anatomy, typically pyramidal neurons are set out with their cell bodies all in one layer, all their long dendrites pointing out in perpendicular to it. So you can actually capture a whole local population with a large-scale electric field, and you can use that to take that whole little population and shift its threshold for activation, or shift roughly its excitability, and you can modulate its response to whatever its inherent inputs are. The last piece of this that's rather useful is that, A, because the frequencies of the field that you put in have to be fairly low, say below 40 hertz, and because the amplitude of the electric field is much lower than you need for pulse stimulation, those things make recording from the same layer of neurons, if you do the instrumentation right, fairly easy to do while you apply this field. So you could do simultaneous stimulation recording. If you could do simultaneous stimulation and recording, or modulation and recording, you could do feedback. So I've spent a lot of my time the last 15 years or so working on this general mode as a working with this general mode of interacting with brain to create feedback systems, A, for controlling seizure, B, for interacting with live neuronal networks and try and understand what they do and how they do it. We've done things like control propagating waves, and I won't tell you too much about these waves, but we had from a theoretical or computational model some predictions about the propagating wave speed of activation of these activity waves, and we had a prediction that said that the speed and the width should depend upon the applied threshold, since we can use this polarizing electric field to modulate that threshold. We then had a prediction that we could speed up, slow down, or halt propagation, and we saw exactly that in brain slice experiments. So these are just three different waves with three different applied fields, and you see their propagation time from here to here is very different, and on many repetitions we're able to reproduce, wave speed versus applied field, and we got wave failure for sufficiently slow applied field. For sufficiently small negative fields. Small negative fields. And we could also do this locally. We're also in brain slices able to close the loop on a seizure control algorithm. The brain slices, they're not really seizures, but they're seizure-like events. And with a simple proportional feedback, we could stop these large kinds of seizure events. And once we turned off the controller, they came right back. In vivo, in rats, we could reproduce the same kind of polarizing modulation, and using a electrode placement that looks very much like what's done for preoperative or pre-resective surgery evaluation with a hippocampal depth electrode stuck down the axis of the hippocampus. And there's our placement for rats, and we have a spontaneous seizure model we use in rats, and here is our first demonstration that we can actually interact with the dynamics ongoing during a seizure just with a open loop applied sinusoidal field. To do this kind of stimulation, we need to be able to safely pass electrical charge. And I'll tell you only a little bit about being able to pass charge, but and about our work developing electrodes materials. But suffice it to say that charge carriers in solids are typically electrons, sometimes they're holes. In liquids, they're ions. There are almost no free electrons in water-based solutions. And so you need to worry about electrochemistry at the electrode tissue interface to increase the amount of, let me play that. If you don't take care of it, you get things like this, which presumably we're creating hydrogen and oxygen bubbles at these electrodes. This typically would be a bad thing. And if you're not careful, this is what you get. So we typically use an iridium oxide coating on our electrodes. In this case, what we do is we change the oxidation level of the iridium to improve the charge passing capacity. So as you change the oxidation level, you either you exchange either hydrogen ions or OH ions with the solution, and as you bring in or take it away electrons from the solid side. And by doing that, you can greatly increase the charge passing capacity of the electrodes. Here we show this for just straight iridium oxide. Basically, the charge passing capacity in this cyclic voltagram is half of the enclosed area. And here's for an this black line in the middle is for an uncoated electrode, and these other circles, this one's for iridium oxide, the others are for mixtures of iridium oxide and conductive polymers. One of the problems that we find is that these electrodes don't perform as well at higher frequencies, and then once you put them in tissue, once you put them in brain, they immediately perform worse and degrade quicker as a function of increasing frequency. And some of the reason for that is, again, that we're trying to exchange with hydrogen and OH ions in solution, and there aren't that many of them, so locally at the surface of the electrode, and so you're mass transport limited, and you're more mass transport limited in tissue. So we need to pay attention to the microenvironment and the actual microanatomy around the cells. And then here we have had a student, Karina and I have had a student now studying just the pH waves or reaction diffusion waves coming off of these electrodes. And here's a fluorescent sensor of pH coming out of this. This is a 150 micron diameter wire. And you can see that these waves of pH propagate just in solution out probably 200-300 microns. And that must be worse in tissue. You're not worried too much. We can do quite a lot of mathematical modeling of this and reproduce it. But now let's talk about testing. When I first started, long before I even started thinking about pH, I started thinking, well, I'm going to start doing animal studies, no longer brain slice studies. I better worry about whether or not I'm causing damage with my simulation. So one of the first things I did was to begin doing histology to see whether or not I could detect additional damage due to the due to stimulation. And I was a converting physicist, so I wasn't trained in histology, so I called up a company and said, what's the best thing to use? What should I be looking at in terms of analysis? And they said, oh, we've got this wonderful degeneration stain. We can find any neurons that are falling apart. The analysis is easy because they just turn up black. Try this. And what we discovered is that every time, I'll get to the second half of that story in a second. Before I get to that, let me remind you about where safety parameters come from for pulse electrical stimulation. And they come from experiments whose results look like this. The experiments are done by putting electrodes either on the surface or into some volunteer's brain. And these come from studies done on, I believe, rabbits. And you drive the current for some amount of time. These were driven for, I think, 8 hours. And the next day, the animals were sacrificed, and the areas under each of the electrodes were stained. And the analysis in the papers really comes out to this. These look normal. These neurons look normal. These neurons look shrunken. So, this is for pulsed microelectrodes. The same kind of analysis was done. Right around here, you've got, I think, here, these look normal. Kind of the, and, this doesn't look damaged, this looks damaged. And with that kind of analysis, they draw a line on some parameter space that says these are bad and these are good. So we wanted, and we kind of didn't think that this analysis, which then looked at the charge per phase and the charge density applied. So this one looks kind of like how much electrochemistry do you do? And this one looks like, I don't know, how many neurons you've excited in the parameter space. And if you excite too many of them with too much electrochemistry, you get a bad result, shrunken neurons. We didn't think this parameter space was quite the right view because we thought, well, if we're simply polarizing the neurons and not forcing them all to fire, you won't get the excitotoxicity kind of thing that you would get from this parameter. So we set out to do our own safety study. And so when we did this, we were doing this neurodegeneration silver stain, and we discovered that every time we stuck an electrode into the brain, we did quite a lot of damage. And the damage was... What's that? No, it's exactly the right thing. So, I say that in a kind of a self-deprecating way, but now I sit no longer in the physics community. I sit somewhere between the physics community, the neurosurgical community, and now in an engineering community that's building all kinds of devices for sticking into brain. And none of them want to hear this, right? All of them want to hear kind of what you probably were taught when you were in neurosurgical school, which was if you put it in really gently, all of the neurons kind of get out of the way. Did people tell you that? No. They may have thought it. It does some damage, right? So the question is how much damage does it do, right? Right. Certainly we expected to have a hole, right? And we expect there not to be neurons around the hole, right? We expected to get a little bit of a scar around the hole. And we expected that if we if we drove more current, we would, might have, you know, we did bad electrochemistry, we'd have a bigger hole and a bigger scar. What we didn't expect was all of this stuff, right? Here's our hole, and way out away in the hippocampus, 3 millimeters away, say, you've got a lot of degeneration going on. And we see this almost independent of the day in which we implant. So this is out 21 days. But we don't see it in our controls, for which we did sham surgeries. So we went up as far as touching the cortex, but not ever placing the electrodes into the brain. And when we study this, we see this across all of the slices. And it's even worse than that. So here's our whole, here's a horizontal section of our animal's brain. We see it way out here, far away from the, but we also see it here in the connection between the two hippocampi and all the way out here into the contralateral hippocampus. And this brings me back to this slide, which I showed you at the beginning, which is that these two hippocampi are inherently connected. If we snip these projections, they fall apart over here. And that's something that one has to worry about. And we've now repeated this in non-human primate. And we just got the slides back last week, so I don't have too much on it. But if you look, here's our little hole. This is a scaled-down DBS electrode. We placed it. We sacrificed the animal 10 days later. You see this little streak of black stuff going down this way. When you look in detail, right around the implant hole, there's degeneration. There are these streaks, and it projects all the way down that track, all the way down here, and it projects through a large fraction of this animal's brain. And these are places we've done damage. So my colleague Joe Francis yesterday talked about stability problems for microelectrode arrays. And the stability problems are stability in recording. You stick these electrodes in. After some amount of time, you start to get less and less recordings, less and less single units that you can see. And if I don't have the histology slides, but the studies that people have done say, oh, well, if we look at the neurons after some amount of time, they don't seem to be near the electrode tip anymore. And the problem is that this is a silicon spike, as much as 150 microns across, maybe slightly less near the tip. This is the Utah style array where the measurements are all done just at the tips of these electrodes. And so there's a mechanical mismatch between this substrate and the different cells and the tissue in general. And so all of the kinds of things that you were talking about come into play in terms of who wants to be near it, right? People are now looking at polymer substrate electrodes. So instead of being, I don't know, 6 or 7 orders of magnitude stiffer than the surrounding tissue, you'll be down around, I don't know what the number is, 2 orders of magnitude too high still. And so the question is, you know, is that really the problem, right? But there's now been and this is things that this group should seek to try and understand, there's now a common statement in the engineering community, which is if you just go to small enough cross-sectional size, if you go to something that's about 4 microns or lower, the cells don't see it. Now, I don't know if this is right. It took me a while after hearing that a couple of times to believe that anybody thought that was true, and then a little bit longer to track down where they were claiming this from. But it comes from one of Daryl Kipke's lab's publications, and it's not explicitly written in this paper. It's kind of derived from this paper. And this paper is this experiment. They took one of their Michigan-style probes, they built these extra superstructures hanging off the sides, and they looked at the histology afterwards, and they said, hey, look, out here around L, we don't see as many neurons moved away. They must have done all kinds of damage, you know, all along this distance as they go in. But I mean, I don't even know if this is true or if this could be true, and if this experiment even tells us what they think it does. But certainly there should be, you know, some better insight as to how to tell if this is right, other than, you know, eventually telling whether or not the recordings are better. And also then, if you're going to go with things that are this small, how do you get them in? And how do you get them in safely, do minimal amounts of damage, and get to the points at which you want to be able to record? How much time was I supposed to be speaking for? What's that? I can talk till 10:30. All right. So that's my charge to this community, and some of the things that I want to, in the next, say, 5 to 10 years, begin thinking about in detail. Now, this brings me to our center's beginning projects in understanding the mechanics or building a material brain program, which is an objective to address what the material properties are of the brain as a whole. How do we bring in and connect up and understand the interaction between the, call it, three intertwined networks, the neurons, the glia, and the vascular system? What are the mechanics of those individual pieces, and how do they combine together to give us the mechanics of the whole system? How does that tell us then where the weaknesses are, what the multi-scale, as a function of scale, how do you damage this structure, right? Is it so simple as, and these are just sketches from Cajal, if I bend it, do I simply have to look at how much the different objects are stretched? And does it matter where I'm looking? Does it matter if I'm looking up here in the, well, does it matter if I'm looking down in the cell body layers or out in the white matter? Or do I need to model each of these separately and then the connections between them? Cajal doesn't even have in these pictures any of the glia or the vascular system. Do I need to worry about damage to each of those structures? You know, the reality is not where Cajal is, but it's somewhere out here. These are from the EM work that people are beginning to do to establish the connectome, where they're doing very, very high resolution, three-dimensional scan, electron microscopy scans of tissue to try and find where all of the neurons are. But you see, there's no extracellular space in this picture, is there? Maybe a very small amount. And so I was talking about, we need to think about all of this mishmash of stuff when we want to think about the mechanics of the actual tissue. And if we want to expand out from this kind of solid mechanics to also understanding the mechanics of, or the dynamics of transport, I'm worried about stimulation. How do I model all of the pH propagation or the the electrochemistry, reaction diffusion in both the extracellular space, and then how do the cells around it respond. I have to articulate what this structure looks like. Same thing if I'm going to look at electromagnetic fields in the tissue, because the modeling of the modeling of both how the electric field from a single neuron propagates out, as well as how a single neuron is polarized with an electric field, right, isn't well understood from a picture of a neuron sitting in an open conductive medium, because there is no open conductive medium in brain. And then there are secondary things that we should all kind of think about. Tissue resistances change as a function of neural activity. Here's a paper studying it as a function of time in an epilepsy model during ictal events. And somehow I lost the picture that went with those tissue resistance changes. In DBS, if you look at the stimulation in impedance, the tissue impedance as a function of frequency changes shortly after you initiate a packet of deep brain stimulation. This is work from Cameron McIntyre's group. If you look at tissue impedance, this is another tissue impedance-like measurement, and it's supposed to be picking up cell swelling, presumably of the glia, as a function of time effectively preceding the onset of a seizure event. And for those of us trying to build seizure control devices and trying to predict what's going wrong, why are you getting seizures, and how do you interact with it to fix it, these kinds of measurements are things we're trying to pick up to, A, to understand what's going wrong, and B, to cue off of to try and fix it if we can, or to stabilize the system. Anyway, I'm going to stop at this.